Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Dairy farming is difficult work as it is, but hearing about what the Hoyt Hill Farmstead, an organic dairy farm in Tunbridge, endured, it can be gut-wrenching because some lashing wire wound up in the cow's feed after it was left in the field by workers installing broadband internet. The small pieces of wire were ingested by at least 70 cows. Three have died from it. Joining us now to talk about the incident and also about fundraising efforts for the farm is Hoyt Hill Farmstead co-owner Amber Hoyt. Amber, thanks for being on with us this morning.
Good morning, Rick. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got a question for Amber, you can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Amber, can you give us an overview of the Hoyt Hill Farmstead?
So Hoyt Hill Farmstead, it is a family farm. Ted and Linda Hoyt, we purchased the farm in 2018, but they've been producing high-quality milk for a long time. And when they transitioned in 2007, we've been Horizon Organic Producers, and we are continuing the tradition of the small organic dairy farm in Vermont. And we chose to do this, and we felt like this was a good decision to make, and we were doing really well. And last year in August, a year ago, we were feeling pretty good about things. And then this happened, and it's been a pretty difficult road.
How many? I said 70. Is that the number of cows you have, or what? How many head do you have there?
So we milk 60. About 70 were exposed to the contaminated feed, and we have anywhere from 60 to 70 heifers as well.
Gotcha. Okay, and share with us again how this wire, and explain what the wire is, got into the hay for your herd.
So back in 2019, I'm sure everybody's heard about the broadband expansion for EC Fiber and ValleyNet, and we're pro broadband.
Sure.
We're very supportive of that. But when the workers were running their lines and using this lashing wire to support the fiber optic cable, they have negligently left behind rolls of lashing wire, and it's been anywhere from along our pastures to, along the roadways, under the poles. We even see it dangling from the lines. And it was a particular crew, we believe. So, unfortunately, that crew and their subcontracting business is no longer in business, or I should maybe say fortunately, because of this incident. But this is something that they put us in a position that we didn't know was there. When our feed was harvested in the summer of 2020, unbeknownst to us and our harvesting crew, there was wire out in our hay fields, and the chopper has a magnet on it, and it didn't detect this wire because it's non-magnetic. So it got chopped into 3/4-inch pieces to, we've got anywhere from 3 to 6-inch pieces. And when we found it back when we opened our 2020 bunk in September of last year, we were finding various sizes, and we just thought, okay, maybe it's a one-time incident. And then we kept finding more. And when we started finding multiple pieces a day, we started making some phone calls. And we found out that it was the lashing wire from this broadband project. So we reached out, and we were assured that the feed would be replaced. And so we started buying clean feed from Canada because last year was a hard year for most producers. There was a drought situation, and trying to find somebody who was willing to work with us for the quantity of organic feed that we needed was pretty difficult. So Mosher's Commodities out of Canada worked with us to provide that 500 tons of feed that we needed. That was about, it was 11 loads of round bales that we had shipped down. And we only did that once the company assured us that they were willing to help pay for the clean feed to replace the feed that was contaminated with the chopped wire. So they paid for 3 loads, which we're very appreciative of, but then they discontinued payment, and we were forced to make the decision to either continue feeding our contaminated feed or to continue accepting the clean feed. So we continued accepting the clean feed because we believe in doing what's right and doing what we can do best for our cows. And after seeing what some of our cows have gone through, and we've lost 3 cows, it's been pretty difficult to try and understand how the people who, told us that they would make things right would, how they could put us in that position to either decide to keep contaminating our cows.
Right.
So it's been a little hard to, we feel like we're good people, and we like to believe that there are still good people out there who are true to their word and willing to make things right. And this is something that could have been avoidable had somebody maybe in the higher ups had made sure that there were maybe protocols being followed more appropriately, or I don't know exactly what those standard operating procedures are for the company, but from what we understand, they're in paper. It's supposed to be done that way. But
yeah, there are probably best practices, Amber, but they aren't always followed 100% of the time. And as we can see, when you cut corners or get sloppy or lazy, there are consequences.
Yes.
Now, the cows that were affected and the cows that died, was this last year before you were able to detect that there was this contaminated feed?
So, unfortunately, no. The first one was in December, and that was after we'd already started feeding clean feed again. The second one was in April, and the last one was at the end of June of this year. And something that's going to be hard for us, and we're just going to keep taking it day by day, is that this can affect them years down the road. So any of those 70 cows that is still in the barn, we're hypersensitive to watching them very closely to see if there's any kind of discomfort. Or we have cows that have got random bloody noses. There's cows that go off feed that's not normal for them. And we're working closely with our vet. And I know Dr. Stewie retired, but we're now working with another young vet, Taylor Hall, with Dr. Barry as well, just to make sure that we're doing the best we can to support these cows if there's anything we can do for them. And unfortunately, with these small pieces of chopped wire, this is causing something which is called hardware disease, and that it could stick with them for years. And at the point where there's high stress, such as calving, it's allowing, once they calve, that's allowing their rumen and their reticulum and all of their stomachs and insides to kind of shift, which then allows, if there is a piece of wire seated somewhere in there, it'll move and it'll cause even further discomfort, or it could possibly kill them.
And I'm a city boy, but I do remember learning a bit about this, but it's probably a good time to talk about bovine's digestive system with the different stomachs that they have.
Yeah, so cows have 4 stomachs. The rumen is the largest, but usually when cows ingest hardware, it will settle straight down into their reticulum. And that's like the very first stomach that sits right along their diaphragm. So if there's any kind of shift, then sometimes it can cause a protrusion or right into their lungs or into their heart, which will kill them.
Mm. And the 3 that did die, could you tell that they were affected, that they were in discomfort before they did die?
Yes, unfortunately. The first one that passed, she was off feed Thanksgiving Day, and it was pretty hard to try and enjoy the holiday, and she just went downhill, and she was off feed for a week, and we had Dr. Stewie out to look at her, and he said, I don't think she's going to make it. So we put her down, and we did a necropsy, and we found wire. And we, the second one, she was a kind of a chronic weight loss cow, and she just wasn't gaining weight no matter how much we tried to feed her or to try and make her comfortable. It wasn't going well. We also put that one down. We did a necropsy and found wire. The third one in June, she had calved a stillborn calf the week before. And, okay, that sometimes happens, so we didn't, we're still trying to think positive. Okay, well, that, unfortunately, that does happen on a farm for whatever reason. And so, we were treating her like we would treat any fresh cow. We were giving her calcium. She was, you know, doing well. And within about a week, so it was probably 5 days, she went off feed. She wouldn't get up. We had all the supportive care that we could do for her, and she perished in her stall. And we opened her up, and there was a very large abscess on her reticulum and diaphragm wall, that, and we found the wire in there. So it's a clear cut, you know, as Dr. Suey said, this is a very black and white situation.
Boy, that had to be the most devastating, being that long after. And so now you know that there could still be other cases. You could lose other cows this long after the fact.
Yes, and this might be something. And we have some really wonderful cows in our herd that are 11 years old, 9 years old, and we feel like they still got a lot of life left to them. Mm-hmm. But now we've got this looming over our head. You know, we've had cows as old as 16 in the barn, and we love our girls, so mm-hmm. it's really hard to watch our family members essentially, you know, go through this.
Amber, I know you said EC Fiber originally was paying for some of the feed, the organic feed that you had to have come from Canada to replace yours. Have they accepted any other responsibility for what has occurred?
No, and unfortunately, I think we've been in touch with them and them with us. Eustace Cable was actually the one who paid for those first three loads, and they stopped because they had told us their insurance company was ready to settle, and they were just waiting on us. Well, that's kind of hard to believe when our insurance claim was denied here recently, 6 months later, 8 months later. EC Fiber did offer to pay for the remaining feed and any losses that we have accrued, but only if we would sign a release liability for them. Unfortunately, we don't feel like we can do that because we don't know how many more cows we're going to lose or what other effects are going to happen essentially
right.
from this.
Yeah. They would pay for right up to this current time, and then anything that happens would be on you and Scott.
Yep.
How has go ahead, Amber.
I wanted to say that there really has been one community member, and there's been a lot, and even our representative we know personally, John O'Brien, but there's been one community member who's pushed us. We were getting really tired and overwhelmed by the situation.
Mm-hmm.
But she's been there, and she helped drive to push us, you know, to help get us through this and one day at a time. But we just want to make sure that everybody knows that anybody who's reached out to us, it's been really appreciated because this is a really difficult time.
Yeah. Well, the community has responded. What have they done to help you kind of with what's happened to you?
So our townspeople put together a couple letters. I believe two have gone to the Senate, and I believe they've been approached by Mark McDonald, and they're in good contact now, just trying to make sure that we're all on the same page. And they're really pushing for, you know, not only for us, but for if anybody else is going to go through this, what can we do? Maybe on a statewide level, of there should be something in place for either emergency funding or, I mean, first of all, we always think that this shouldn't have happened in the first place.
Right.
So how can we prevent this in the future?
So none of the organizations that we normally think of, like a NOFA, Vermont Organic Farmers Association, have that kind of emergency fund that could help you or others who face a situation like this?
So there is a small emergency fund or grant for NOFA, and I'll admit I haven't taken the time to fill that out yet, but it's only $2,500, but that $2,500 is going to go directly towards that feed bill, and we will be filling that out, but that's very small in comparison to what we've accrued here in a very short amount of time, and our margins are very thin as a dairy farm. All dairy farms have very thin margins. And to be able to cover the feed bill that we needed to make that right decision for our animals and our farm, it's far exceeded what we would be able to cover on our own.
Is there a point where you can ever feel comfortable using the hay from that field that was contaminated with the wire?
We don't know. We're actually going to be opening up our 2021 season feed next week, and we're crossing our fingers that it was all swept up last year, but there's a very real possibility that it's in this year's feed too.
Yeah, very real. I mentioned before we went to the break that there's a GoFundMe campaign. You can go to GoFundMe.com. It's the Hoyt Hill Feed Fund. Now, who got that started?
So that was our relatives, my relative's cousin, and she very kindly had reached out and said, "Do you need us to do this?" And we've been very hesitant. And for the last couple months, there have been people that say, "Well, why don't you do this?" And we feel like a GoFundMe is something that we don't quite fit the bill for.
Right.
And we know that people work really hard for their money, and we work really hard for our money, but we don't feel like we should have to take that from somebody when the responsible parties should be covering it. But when we take a step back and we look at how overwhelming our situation is, it's kind of sinking.
Yeah. Now, the goal has been set for $50,000. When I first checked it last week, it was about at $12,000. Yesterday, it was up to $15,000. Do you know how much has been raised so far?
So when I checked yesterday, it was still at $15,000, and all of that money is going to be going to cover feed. And just to give you an idea, the bales that we were buying from Canada were $110 a bale. So a load was 48 bales, about $5,200 a load.
Wow.
So that funding then would cover about three more loads of that clean feed that we bought.
Mm. As you mentioned earlier, you're an organic dairy farm, and I know you can't talk about the specifics by the recent move by Horizon. So on top of what you've been going through and still are going through with the feed problem with the cows, you've now, I guess, lost the contract with Horizon. Is that correct?
So we still have a contract through August of next year.
Okay.
And yeah, it's kind of a double whammy to have this situation going on top of, you know, and then get that letter in the mail. But we're young, we're strong, we're very prideful of what we do, and we're going to find one way or another to continue doing what we love. And hopefully, maybe by getting this GoFundMe, you know, to keep going and to cover our feed bill, we can take a deep breath and keep moving forward and thinking about, you know, what we can do to continue on.
Still committed to dairy, still committed to organic dairy through all of this, Amber?
Yes, yes. And we've been committed to Horizon since 2007, so
wow.
We've never jumped ship, but I guess now our hand is going to be forced.
Right. Does this discourage you and Scott, you know, at all? You know, I know you sound a little bit discouraged, yet still, you know, you're telling us you have the belief, you have the commitment to carry on. You know, this is a time when we keep watching one dairy farm after another in the state sell off. I spoke to Corey Chapman yesterday, a nearby family farm there in Tunbridge, that last year decided that was it. They sold the herd and they have sold the farm. The farm has been sold off, and they've, you know, given up completely on it. You and Scott and your family still committed to this?
Yes, yes. And Corey's a good friend, and it was really hard to see him. He was a fellow Tunbridge farmer.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to see him and his family sell. But I know it was the move that they needed to make. You've got to make the best decision for your family. But we're committed to making it work, and I'm hopeful that one way or another, either Organic Valley or Stoning Field or maybe even a third party, I know the state has a advocacy group and a task force working, trying to, you know, figure out one way that somehow that we can get this Northeast milk or at least Vermont's milk, because it's already, you know, I believe it's 28 farms that we're going to need to find a home for.
Mm-hmm.
For their milk if they're going to continue on. So I think Vermont is also a very strong, independent state that we can figure it out one way or another.
I like that spirit. And what do you have to say to those who have started the GoFundMe campaign, those who have contributed so far?
we're extremely, extremely thankful, and we appreciate every single donation, big or small. And I know there's been some anonymous donations that, you know, we won't be able to recognize you if you have made them, but we appreciate it so very much. And there's been a lot of kindness shown to us, which really helps during this hard time for us.
It must be somewhat humbling to have that outpouring of support.
Yes, and even from people who are, you know, have very little or no, you know, connection to dairy, reaching out and sending us notes, and even Senator Becca Belint had sent us a very, very kind note and apologizing about what's been going on with our situation, and just is, it really is touching to be able to hear from people that you didn't think would, you know, ever care about this kind of situation.
It's Amber Hoyt, her and Scott Hoyt, co-owners of the Hoyt Hill Farmstead in Tunbridge. Let me give that address one more time, GoFundMe.com. It's the Hoyt Hill Feed Fund is how you can show your support. Amber, thanks so much for being on with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me, Rick.
Sure thing. Take care. All right, we're going to take a break, and then we'll return to learn about the Vermont Fusion Women's Soccer Club in Manchester. And the Sox open up 4-game series at the Trop. They're going to face the AL East leading Rays tonight. Our coverage begins at 6:10, first pitch at 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. What a great step forward for women's sports in Vermont. This summer, the Vermont Fusion were an expansion team in the Women's Premier Soccer League, or WPSL, playing their home games at Applejack Stadium in Manchester. In addition, coming up this Saturday, they have a program called Mia to Meg and Beyond, which is a discussion about the recent history of U.S. women's soccer, the current challenges, the possibilities. Joining us to tell us about the soccer club and this weekend's program is Eric Perry. He's the vice president and director of operations of the Vermont Fusion. Eric, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Oh, thank you, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
It's great having you. Now, listeners, if you've got a question for Eric, or if you made it to one of the Fusion's games this season, or maybe you have a child playing with the Fusion, you can give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Eric, give us an overall picture of what Vermont Fusion is on the various age and skill levels.
Yeah, absolutely. So Vermont Fusion goes back to Fusion Soccer Club, formed when, you know, some local community clubs were fighting for players. They formed Fusion. This was more than 25 years ago. There was an existing tournament, which we always held, and the Green Mountain Challenge, which is held every third weekend in June, except for, you know, the previous year due to COVID, but we were able to pull one off for 21. So that has always kind of supported the club and allowed us to do, you know, keep our scholarships high and our pricing low, as affordable as possible for our local soccer community. We typically have about 200 to 250 kids in a spring season. And we have started some fall programs, but we typically are only a spring travel program. Beyond the recreational level, we want to provide high-level coaching and really opportunities for kids to enjoy sport in the springtime.
Boys and girls, Eric?
Yes, ages U8 to U18 or 19 at this point. You know, if you include our WPSL team as a youth group, they would be considered U23 or U24 age level. But, you know, we have some college graduates playing on the Women's Premier Soccer League team for Vermont Fusion.
And why is and was this, the Fusion Soccer, something you and your wife really wanted to build for the Southern Vermont soccer community?
Yeah. Well, we moved kind of back to Manchester. My wife, Sarah, who's the president of the club, mm-hmm. She was really a field hockey girl, but, you know, organizationally and the way she connects with people, she was a perfect fit for the president's role in our club. I joined, you know, Fusion about 10 years ago when we moved here to Southern Vermont. Prior to that, we've been living in Hyde Park, Vermont for 25 years. Just made some choices for where the kids are going to be going to school and Burn Burton Academy. So my wife went to high school there when she was attending. So it was an opportunity that we had to kind of place them down here and be in a good place. I was kind of pulled into the club as parents often are when they see, you know, connections and people that are willing to work and volunteer some time. And my knowledge of soccer. So, you know, 10 years later, we're doing what we're doing now and really feeling like we've brought the club along to a good place.
Well, I'm a massive soccer fan, but when I go out and watch women play field hockey, I got to say it's one of the most wonderful sports. And I love my soccer players, but they could not handle the punishment that the women playing field hockey have to go through when they're out there playing, and especially in the colder months. So.
Absolutely. And then during the Olympics this year, they were able to watch the men's field hockey as well. It's an amazing sport, and a lot of those skills combine into, you know, European clubs and the men are playing both sports as well. So it's a great sport combined. So,
now, Eric, not including the WPSL squad, where do the players come from who are part of Vermont Fusion?
Yeah, great, good question. Typically, our younger ages are mostly local. So that would include Manchester, surrounding towns, you know, Londonderry, Peru, Landgrove, Arlington, down to Bennington. Some of our older groups definitely get, so we're probably at, you know, 10 to 12 different communities that we're pulling kids from, all the way from Fairhaven down to Bennington, over to almost Brattleboro in the Jamaica area, of Southern Vermont. So it's really a wide ranging, regional club at those older levels. And we really continue to attract, more kids, especially with the influx of new people coming into Vermont.
And you mentioned it's a traveling club. So where will your squads play?
Yeah, typically we would, Fusion in the past has been in the youth club as far as we would travel to tournaments. So we had been, you know, ramping up to traveling to different tournaments, say, in New Hampshire, Maine, some in Massachusetts. This year we played in the Vermont Soccer League, which geographically is even more challenging due to the, you know, the 2 hour plus drive time for northern teams to come see southern teams or vice versa. So, it's a little bit more challenging just for a single game. So we'll probably gravitate back towards being a tournament club for the youth, and having local matches and friendlies for local play and getting playing time locally, so we don't have to travel so much.
Is there an overriding philosophy and or a mission for how you coach, how you manage the teams that represent Fusion Soccer?
Yep, definitely. Development in developing young kids into playing sports and athletes. I've always been a multi-sport supporter in that you can play one sport per season typically. The younger kids can get away with others or two, but it often is a conflict of time and energy for people to really commit themselves. So one sport per season, multiple sports per year, really creates a good balance. And I think, you know, that hyper focus of year round athletes doing the same sport is what we've tried to avoid, and encouraging kids to do different things.
Mm-hmm. And then what do you hope the players take with them as they move upward and onward through Fusion and beyond?
Yeah, I think the friendship of it, you know, developing good community members, I think ultimately would be my goal for coaching. I mean, I want them to learn the sport. I want them to learn the camaraderie and the communication that you need to have when you're being coached or being a mentor for other kids or being a leader on a team or just, you know, joining something new that you're not comfortable with and being comfortable with that and moving forward to have the confidence in other areas of their life, whether it's going to school or seeing new things and meeting new people. It could be a variety of things. And it's really a community-based things where we ask a lot of volunteers from our local parents and community members. And sometimes that is hard to find because people are busy.
Where have your kids gone on to play as far as in college programs around the country?
Yes, we have a variety of kids playing at different colleges. There's some local talent here that are at Williams, You know, some kids go on to play, you know, Hannah Pincus, who grew up here in town, who was on our Fusion, WPSL team. She's at Colgate. Her sister Grace is at UMass, Amherst. So there's, you know, a variety of kids who choose to focus on that and really stick with it through their college career as well. We haven't typically in the past focused on that, you know, higher level kind of placement in college teams because, you know, honestly, the percentages of kids, that are looking for that hasn't been high. And, you know, that we're focused on the club side as keeping kids playing from 13 to 15 to 18, where, you know, percentages show that in many sports, and soccer is not, you know, outside of that we lose a lot of kids in sports at those ages.
Yeah.
So I think in engaging them to do that and not pressuring to say you have to play in college because it's a whole commitment just to go to college.
Eric, I've been reading about that for decades, about that kind of age drop off and participation drop off. What is it that are the motivating factors where kids kind of take a step out from the sports that they've been playing for all those years?
I think some of it is the competitiveness of it, the pressure of, you know, making the team or not. We've always tried to then at the club and youth level to be inclusive. And whether you're a beginner at 14 or 15 years old, you should have a place to play within reason, you know, to bring your skills up if you're interested in doing that. Because the way kids develop, you know, girls obviously develop a little bit quicker between the 14 to 16 range. And then once they're in high school, they're really kind of, you know, young ladies at this point. Men, I think, are still developing. The boys are still developing at, you know, 15 to 18. And now they're really, you know, becoming strength and using the intelligence and what they learn in the game to move forward at a little bit later age than the girls.
Eric, this was the first year of having this franchise in the Women's Premier Soccer League, the WPSL. First of all, tell us about that organization.
Yeah, so we became interested in having a higher-level team with the opportunities that we have with the Applejack Stadium and the town of support from the town of Manchester as well. The WPSL seemed like the right league fit for us. Just like the men's game and the women's game, there's multiple different levels of you know, commitment or levels of play that you have. And really, the WPSL is the next level from the National Women's Soccer League team, which is where the pros are playing here in the United States and Canada. So we're right on the stepping stone of that. It's one of the bigger leagues in the world. And I think there's 130 teams in the United States and Canada, possibly. Things were broken down a little bit more this year with the way the league was set up, but we thought that this was a great opportunity. The values and the vision seemed to be in line with where we'd like to be, and we went for it and got into the WPSL.
So you play in a regional conference within the WPSL. So where are the other teams that the Fusion was playing?
Yeah, so we played the New York Shockers out of Albany. We played the Rhode Island Rogues, who are out of Providence, Rhode Island. Then there were some teams in the Long Island area. SUSE was down on Long Island. Westchester United was just north of New York City, I believe. So they kind of broke it down. So travel was a little less. Typically in the past, there would be a bigger budget for travel and expenses on that. So we were able to, you know, minimize the COVID exposure in that time, as well as you know, not have overnight trips. It does make for a longer commitment in that we're further away from most of the teams than the other teams are from their other, you know, competitors. So it is a challenge for us, a little bit financially, being a nonprofit and running this team this way to pay for that and these travel expenses, because it is quite a bit.
Where were the players from who played on that WPSL squad this summer?
Yeah, for the Vermont Fusion, we had mainly, you know, a good contingency of Vermont players. We also, you know, we're able to tap into our local community right within Manchester and the surrounding players. There's a few Fusion players on there, which is great to see, you know, that they've come through and they're playing in the ranks of, you know, say, the Williams and the other ones we discussed earlier. Mm-hmm. So to see them playing locally. But we also had girls from New Hampshire, from Maine. We had girls from Massachusetts. We had girls from New York State. One of our goalies, Aaron Murphy, is from University of Buffalo. I think she grew up in the Long Island area. We also had a girl, Taylor, was from Hawaii, and Nicole was from Colorado. They go to a school in California together. So they through the Soccer World connections that we were able to make, found us. And we also had, you know, we had quite a few inquiries. We had over 55 applicants for this team. There were no tryouts. Everything was done on the phone or kind of in a recruiting sense on the phone or talking with coaches and other players. So it was quite a process and very interesting to see and be part of.
So I'm guessing because we know the Vermont Mountaineers summer college baseball team here been around for almost 20 years. Is this something on that level where the players, the women, maintain their college eligibility but get to play at a higher level during the summer?
Absolutely, yes. It's right in line with that same idea. There's no place for these college players to play, and the level of play in New England and in the Northeast is really high. So, you know, knowing what Vermont has to offer, what we can offer here in Manchester with Applejack and the training facilities that we can, we really have an opportunity to attract a lot of people, and I think a really high level of play will come with that.
Now, it was the first year at this new level. The Fusion did pretty well. Tell people how you finished.
Yeah, so honestly, I don't know our exact schedule, but I think we won 5, lost 2, tied 2. So we were essentially a winning season. For me, the success kind of, I wasn't directly involved with the coaching side. I really took a role as supporting the players in their lives outside of the team. So I was able to, acquire some housing. We had different in-home stays. So that's really the role that I took. My level of success was that we were able to, first of all, in this season, have games, bring this team together with all these different people coming together. The timing fit right in behind where, the COVID restrictions and mandates fell down, and we were able to open up a little bit. So it was fortunate for us that we were able to pull this off in this way. All the players are really happy with the season that we had. Numbers of them, I mean, not just one or two, but an overall sense, they were saying, these girls have played thousands of games on many, many different fields in many places, that the fields we have here and Applejack Stadium are some of the nicest, if not the nicest fields they've ever played on, which is really an honor for us to be able to put this together and have a successful season. Fans are happy. The coaches are happy. Everybody wants to come back, and we already have, returning players saying they want to come. So that's, to me, is a successful season, and we're over the top about it. Thinking about next year already.
Fusion finished second in their conference, a very good season. They play at the beautiful and wonderfully named Applejack Stadium. We better get on to the program you have coming up this Saturday in the last few minutes we have, Eric. It's called Mia de Meg and Beyond. And first of all, what is the program that this is all about?
Yeah, so this is following a Middlebury and Williams game, I believe, are the two teams that are playing a preseason match. The town of Manchester has been very supportive in locating and finding teams to come here and play these games in town. It's a neutral location for the different teams. So following that will be the Mia to Meg presentation. The idea was to, get some of the soccer kind of movers and shakers together in the community and in the region and really have this forum to have a discussion, because there is a bigger opportunity here, and I think it's bringing these minds together and having this discussion. It just hasn't happened in the past, and it's great timing for it. This is the right place for it, and I think that there'll be a great discussion from this moving forward, and it will not only benefit women's sports and girls in general, but also, boys as well. So it's a community benefit to all of this.
Who can attend Saturday's presentation?
I believe it's open to the public and free. I believe it will be on the local GNET, which is Greater Northshire Area TV. I believe they have a website, and that's I've been told that was going to be broadcast on there. But it is free to attend this seminar.
Eric, with the program you have this Saturday, Mia to Meg and Beyond, with this WPSL club in your community now in Manchester, what impact does having that have on the younger girls coming up in the club and in the Southern Vermont community?
Yeah, it absolutely inspires. You know, I guess I work from the top down. We've always been a developmental club, but having the WPSL team really shows these girls that there's an opportunity for them to play at a really high level under the lights on a beautiful field in front of, you know, hundreds of people in their own town. So that, if that's not inspiring for them alone, you know, just meeting the girls and the players on the field after the games was something we made a point of doing to make them open and accessible. And I think being able to walk on the field after a game, you know, like that, win, lose, or draw, really is inspiring for them. And parents see that. And I think they are encouraging to keep their kids involved with sports and other activities.
What's the future hold for the Vermont Fusion?
Well, we're definitely moving forward. We have a 3 to 5 year plan. You know, it was a challenging start to the year because at first we didn't really know if we were going to be able to go. You know, we are typically, as I said, our tournament supports our youth club. So we had typically not in the past, not done lots of fundraising or asked for sponsorships or any outside money other than what the club could raise. So, you know, we are not professional fundraisers, but certainly we are able to make the connections with the local community and kind of paint the picture for what we could do. And honestly, we did that. We had almost 800 people at one evening game and at Applejack Stadium, which is probably one of the biggest crowds they've ever had there, definitely for a soccer match. And that alone, I think, is opening people's eyes to the opportunity of not only exposure for their businesses, but certainly for, you know, the opportunity to be part of something that is growing and getting bigger. And there's a lot of momentum with this.
Nicely done.
I think, you know, yeah, it's exciting.
Yeah. Eric Perry is the Vice President, Director of Operations of the Vermont Fusion. Listeners, to learn more about the club and the Mia to Megan Beyond program that's this Saturday, you can visit vtfusionsoccer.com. Eric, great having you on this morning. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for reaching out, and this has been a great opportunity. Thank you.
All right, take care. We're going to break for news, and then we'll return to chat with Julia Rogers of En Route Consulting about taking a gap year. And today at 1, it's 3 full hours of The Getaway with the Honorable Mr. Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I was 17 when I went off to college. Didn't turn 18 until I was home for Christmas vacation of my freshman year. If we talked about gap years back then, I might have been a prime candidate to take a year to mature, explore, get myself ready for college. I made it through in 4 years, but I will say that in my freshman year, I did question if I was really ready for the academic demands of college. We're going to discuss gap years this morning, what they are, how they benefit a student, and what kinds of things your current high school student might consider doing if they determine that a gap year makes sense for them. Here to talk about it is Julia Rogers. She's the founding director of En Route Consulting. Julia is also former president of the Gap Year Association, and she is here to tell us all about the gap year. Thanks so much for being on Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Excellent. Now, listeners, if you'd like to ask Julia a question about the need for and the logistics of gap years, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Julia, what is the basic concept of the gap year?
Sure. Well, you know, in essence, a gap year is really an intentional period of personal growth, typically taken at an inflection point in one's development. So most commonly we think of a gap year maybe after high school and before higher education, but you can also take a gap year after college and before the workforce or in between college and grad school, or, you know, there's also an increased prevalence in mid and post-career gapping as well. So I would say that I really advocate for that post-high school gap year, but there's really no wrong time to take a gap year if you are at kind of a moment of transition in your education or life.
Oh, interesting. What made you aware of the general idea, the benefits of the gap year?
Right. Well, I took a gap year myself, as many people in my field have, you know, felt that transformative period of time. I graduated from college on time from Hamilton College in New York State, and I spent my gap year after college in Tanzania. I spent almost a year there doing public health work, and that year was incredibly formative for me and helped kind of, you know, really open my eyes to what the stuff that I was made of. You know, I learned so much about myself and my interests. The program and the work that I was doing, I felt was very meaningful. And so I came away from that experience really wondering what my college education would have been like if I had had that experience after high school and before college rather than after my college experience. Because I think that that experience, my gap year, would have really reinformed my reasoning, my motivation, and what I, my field of study once I, if I had done it, you know, beforehand.
I'm going to show off just a little. Hamilton College, their nickname is the Continentals. I think the only school that
yes.
I... and the colors are...
Funky mascot, but yes.
The colors are buff and blue. All right, enough about that. How many students have you worked with who have taken gap years?
Right. Well, right after my epiphany, after my gap year, I quickly, you know, got to work about a year after that with getting my company started. So I've been working with gap year students for almost 13 years. So I've worked with hundreds of kids, you know, in that time period. But I work, you know, generally I work with about 45 to 50 students a year individually and counsel and do talks and reach a wider audience at a well.
Wow. Okay. That's quite a bit. So, you know, when I think of gap year students, I certainly didn't think, there would be that many, that who were considering it, that were doing it. So, that's quite impressive. What are the main reasons students are taking a gap year now?
Right. Well, a lot of students, you know, I think that there's the normal times, the before times, if you will, and then there's the now times. So obviously over the past year and a half, we've seen, you know, a lot of students choosing to take a gap year as a direct result of COVID.
Right.
So not wanting to go into their college experience virtually or with that uncertainty around what the college experience is going to be like at this moment, especially with the price tag attached. You know, so there's, that is a main motivator, I think, for this past year and a half. But typically, you know, and even during COVID times, students really take gap time as this opportunity to take a pause and reflect on what they want out of their higher education experience, also to develop those life skills and soft skills that are so important in the workplace. So it's really an opportunity to kind of get both ends of that, you know, get the personal development as well as the professional development kind of underway before you start and make these big decisions about how, what you want to study and what you might want to quote unquote do for the rest of your life, even though that's a misnomer in itself.
Now, you even said gap time in that previous answer as opposed to gap year. So are there times where someone will take just a semester or, you know, summer and fall off rather than a full year?
Certainly, yes. And I'm glad you caught that because we kind of define a gap year or gap time as anywhere from 2 months to 2 years. The most typical amount of time is a school year time period. So that's, you know, what, 13, 14 months, kind of the summer after you graduate to the following summer or the end of the following summer. But people sometimes take a gap semester, or we're seeing a lot of students get kind of a deferred semester off. So, you know, a student, they say, the school might say to a student, hey, we're happy to have you as a second semester freshman. So that means they're allowed to come in January rather than August or September. So then they have kind of a gap semester. And then I worked with a student actually from the Upper Valley this year who took a full gap year, had incredible experiences, and wanted to extend that time. So, you know, she is just deferred for a second year to have another year full of kind of experiential learning experiences and will be gaining college credit. So will actually enter college as a sophomore through this second gap year experience of experiential learning that has college credit attached to it.
Oh, that's golden. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
Now, Julia, are there certain types of students or individuals who really benefit from a gap year?
So I'm pretty biased in that I think that just about anybody who's willing to engage with the concepts around gap time, the personal motivation that it takes, can benefit from it. But I would say that there's kind of two or three categories of students I would say are most, you know, good candidates for gap time. That would be your high-performing, high-achieving students who are at risk for burnout, because those are the kids who have been pushing themselves and stressing out and, you know, they're just kind of they're really, really motivated, but they're also need a bit of a break and kind of an opportunity to explore other things. Then there's our students who are experiential learners and really have never super thrived in a classroom environment. And they really benefit from exploring the world outside the classroom and regaining their motivation to get, you know, some sort of higher education certification based on their gap year experiences. And then there's a huge, you know, and growing, unfortunately, number of students who really need to take a wellness or a mental health gap year because of COVID and just the, you know, increasing prevalence of anxiety and depression and other challenges that our youth are experiencing. So sometimes students will take gap time, you know, to kind of get ready to get that strong foundation for their step into adulthood.
So, Julia, how do you help or consult with a family to determine, first of all, if the gap year or gap time is right for their student?
Right. Well, I think that when I'm talking to a family, anybody who has a student who's in, you know, junior or senior high school is welcome to come to me for kind of just a consult brainstorming session that's completely complimentary. And usually during that session with the family, student and parents, we talk about, you know, why they're thinking about a gap year. And I think that the most important factor is that the student is bought into the concept. You know, parents cannot force a kid to take a gap year. That's a recipe for disaster. And so there's this delicate balance of a parent maybe saying, like, we think this is a great opportunity for you, and a student engaging with the process and really deciding that they want to challenge themselves and take this road that's not yet the most common road, but is still increasingly common. So I think that just a student being bought into the idea and the concept and the promise of gap time is the most important factor.
And then what guidance or services do you provide?
Right. Well, a lot of families come to me and they're excited about the general concept of a gap year, but they're a bit confused and maybe even overwhelmed by the variety of options available because there are quite a lot of things that you and directions that you can go. So my job as a counselor is to get to know a student, help them develop some goals and some anchors for their gap time, and then really distill down the world of opportunities into a manageable field of options. So I'm recommending programs that I've vetted and sometimes visited myself. Or sometimes if a student wants to do something really independent, like I have a student this year who's buying a motorcycle and going to do like a motorcycle backpacking trip in the Northeast.
Excellent.
So for him, we're working together to kind of come up with his plan and his route and the budget and those kinds of elements that kind of you have to think about to execute a more independent gap year opportunity.
Mm. All right. So you were your former president of the Gap Year Association, and you're also the current chair of the GYA's Outreach Committee. What is the GYA, the Gap Year Association?
Right. The Gap Year Association is a 501c nonprofit, and it's the official standards development organization for gap year education in the U.S. And it's recognized by the U.S. Department of Justice and Federal Trade Commission as such. So we're kind of the governing body of the gap years in the states, if you will.
Hmm.
So the Gap Year Association is an excellent landing point for any family who wants neutral, high-quality information about taking a gap year. So the website is gapyearassociation.org. But the GYA actually accredits gap year programs and counselors for quality, safety practices, those kinds of things. So you can actually look at a list of vetted programs on their website, which is a huge shortcut for families looking for high-quality gap year programming. And then there's also all sorts of data collection that we do and outreach and communications and memberships and all other things that students can tap into through the GYA.
Path to a college degree and subsequent career is different for everyone, and it doesn't always mean going right from high school graduation in June to stepping onto a college campus 2 months later. Julia Rogers of En Route Consulting knows that well, and she has been helping students to find that route since 2007, is it, Julia?
Well, I actually took my gap year in 2007. So I think En Route was founded in 2008.
Okay,
or
good.
9. Yes, it's right. A long time ago.
I have 2008, so I'll stick with that. All right. And
yeah,
listeners,
that sounds good.
you can speak with Julia about gap years, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. I think I did my homework, but then I got a little nervous about it. All right. Let's go to the phones and talk to Michelle from Plainfield. Hi, Michelle. Go right ahead.
I think that the term gap year is maybe 20 years old or something like that. So before there was that, there was just dropping out for a while.
That's true.
And I dropped out of college after my first year. I was just very restless.
Yeah.
And I was angry at everything. And And so then I worked in a bank for 6 months, and that taught me, oh, I want that college degree.
Yeah.
I really don't want to work in a bank. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but this is not for me. And then I went back to school after 6 months, and I was really motivated. And so I just wanted to say that as another example of that you might be just not really ready or just restless, and then you see what the world is, and you really want, you get much more motivated to study.
Michelle, well done. This brings us to some points that I'm going to ask Julia about. But I finished college in my 4 years, went out into the work world for about two and a half years, and realized that all through, you know, grade school, high school, college, I was accepting being a B student, and went out into the work world and became a B worker, and realized that if I wanted a career, I needed to learn how to be an A person. Never had a 4.0 in my life. So took those 2.5 years to learn, you know, to realize that, went back to grad school with a different mentality and finished with a 4.0. But Julia, you find this with the students you work with in that gap year, that it really does strengthen things for the individual. So talk about that, how they come back from that gap year with that different perspective that we heard from Michelle. You know, what goes on, and then how do they kind of readjust when they go back to college?
Yeah, it's such a great point, Michelle. I'm so glad that you brought that up, because that's exactly, you know, 20 years hence, we're still seeing that same outcome with students who take intentional gap time, you know, this day and age. We've actually, you know, the Gap Year Association does surveys periodically about every 5 years, where we do a big, you know, survey across the United States to kind of understand the outcomes for gap year students, and they self-report their outcomes. So motivation is one of the top indicators that they talk about as far as a benefit to their gap time. About 84% say that their gap year directly increased their academic motivation. But even more than that, say that their 98% say that their maturity increased as a result of their gap year, and 97% say that their self-confidence increased as a result of their gap year. So students are just arriving much more prepared emotionally for their college experience after their gap time. And I think that that's a lot due to the fact that a gap year really asks the student, you know, what are you interested in? What are you curious about? Go explore that on your own terms. And there's no wrong way to take a gap year as long as it's your choice. So and that it's intentional. So going to work for a year is a great way to spend a gap year. There's other ways that you can also stretch yourself by, you know, living independently, by traveling, by doing an internship or volunteering. So there's so many ways to kind of tap at those, you know, those skills, but the outcomes are, you know, very, very beneficial. And anecdotally, I hear it all the time as well. But we are kind of working to get that data to back it up.
But Julia, is it like, I'm going to put it in political terms, coming out of the national convention, you know, the candidates have their big national convention, and then they have that bump in the polls. I mean, does this happen where you come out of your gap year and, you know, you're all motivated for the first year or so, and then it trails off?
Well, there are some academics doing some really great research around this, and some of it being done in our own state. So Bob Claggett, who is a former dean of admissions for Middlebury College, actually spearheaded research at Middlebury around outcomes for gap year students in the academic sense. So he started doing side-by-side comparisons of gap year students versus traditional students, and monitoring their academic performance over the course of their entire college experience, and found that their gap years always outperformed the traditional students academically, and it did not diminish after the first or second year. It stayed kind of true through all 4 years. And this was, you know, when all other factors were accounted for in that kind of, you know, processing of the data.
Now, Michelle took, you know, some time off, worked. I did the same thing after college and worked. Is that what the gap year is all about? Do they just work, or what kind of experiences do you recommend they try?
Well, I think that experiencing a different place is a really important aspect of a gap year. But think about it this way. You know, a lot of my students will do multiple things over the course of this, you know, 12 to 14 month period of time. I would say a working experience is a very important component of that. So a lot of students will either work for the summers, you know, to bookend their gap year experiences, and they get a summer job. Or some students will work for 6 months and then stay and then go on a either a program or some other adventure for 6 months. So having a mix of experiences, I think, is the most beneficial way of gapping, because the more you experience on the gap year, the more information you're taking in about the world around you, the more you're experimenting with your interests. And even better is to kind of get into other cultures. And by other cultures, I don't mean necessarily traveling internationally. That's fantastic. It's a great way to spend gap time. But I had a student this year who actually did COVID relief in Southern California. I had another talked to another student recently on my through my podcast who actually did he was assisting doing videography for people who were solving cold cases in deep south of the U.S. And that student was from Washington State, had a very different outlook on life, and was visiting these other very, very culturally different areas of our own country. So I think that, you know, exploring outside of your own bubble is the most one of the most important components of gap time, whatever that means for you.
Well, if you're not working, you know, it can be costly. It can be out of the range of a family. And I noticed that the GYA, the Gap Year Association, does provide aid for gap years, possibly.
Yes. There's many ways to kind of self-fund or fund a gap year experience. And so that can be either through seeking out scholarship funding, which is available privately through different gap year organizations if you want to go on a program. But then there's, you know, the biggest gap year program provider in the United States is actually AmeriCorps. So when you think of a domestic Peace Corps experience, that's what, you know, kind of what AmeriCorps is. And you can join one of their programs, for example, NCCC, which is a 10-month long fully funded program where you get a living stipend, all your travel and living expenses are taken care of, and you get to visit different areas of our country doing volunteer work and different types of relief. Sometimes it's disaster relief. Sometimes this year it's been COVID relief and helping out at vaccination sites and such. Sometimes it's environmental work and building trails in our national parks. So that is an example of not only a fully funded gap year experience, but if you do an AmeriCorps program, you actually get a Siegel Education Award, which can be up to $6,000 that you can put towards college afterwards. So a gap year can actually be a cost positive experience if that's what your family, if that's the right fit for your family. So I would say when people ask me about budgeting for a gap year, I would say that really you can take a gap year for any amount of money. You just have to strategize and be thoughtful about where you put those funds.
Wow, I love the different opportunities you're presenting. I would have not thought of, you know, a tenth of them. So thank you so much for telling us about these, Julia. Take us through how you and the family start the process, make a decision on what the student will do during the gap year.
Sure. So, yeah, typically students and families will find their way to me around fall of senior year, so around, you know, between now and, you know, winter time of senior year. And we come together either for an in-person or virtual conversation to kind of talk through what is a gap year, kind of like this conversation, but in more specific terms. So if a student says, you know, I love being in the outdoors, I'm interested in environmental science, but I don't know, and I also speak Spanish, we might talk through the generalities of what a gap year using those kinds of anchors could look like and answer questions and things like that. And that, again, is all complimentary, and you can find me at enroutegapyear.com if you'd like to reach out to schedule that conversation. But then, you know, if a student engages with me formally, then I'm with them throughout their whole gap year. So it's not just the planning and then I send you on your way. I'm with you from whenever we engage through the end of a gap year experience so that I can be with you not just through the planning process, but also through the pre-departure prep and support throughout the gap year, and then debriefing and doing some transition work at the end of your gap year to talk about what happens. You know, most of my students are college bound afterwards, but some students do vocational school, join the military, go straight into the workforce after gap time. So it can also help provide clarity about your onward path if you take a gap year. Mm.
Julia, we have a minute left. How do you work with educators?
Sure. Well, I work with school counselors a lot. I'm always happy to come in for a presentation. I've been doing lots and lots of Zoom presentations as well. So if you want to educate your student body around gap time, please get in touch, and I'd be delighted to work with you on figuring out how I can get information to you and your students. And for any interested parent, it's the same thing. I can do talks to PTOs. I can do parent group chats, those kinds of things. So any way that I can provide general resources to our Vermont community is such a pleasure. I'm always happy to do it.
Julia Rogers is the founding director of En Route Consulting, also former president of the Gap Year Association, current chair of the GYA's Outreach Committee. Listeners, to learn more about her work, you can visit enroutegapyear.com. Julia, thanks for all this great information.
Thank you so much, Rick. Have a great day.
I'm afraid you might have inspired our director, Danny McGivrigan, so much he's going to walk out on me after this, but let's hope that that doesn't
happen. Tell him to call me, and I'll talk to you.
All right. All right.
Thanks, Rick.
Take care. Let's break for a CBS News update, and then we're going to learn about another cool Vermont company. They're all about the deep sea. And coming up today at 11, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Richmond, Vermont isn't necessarily the location I'd expect for a company that creates amazing products used in the ocean, but this is Vermont, and we do seem to follow a whole different set of rules from the rest of the pack. Green Sea Systems is the company we're going to hear about up until 11 o'clock, and maybe we'll learn that we just aren't familiar with the vastness of Richmond Pond or Iroquois Lake. I mean, why else would Green Sea be in Richmond? Joining us to share their story is Dawn D'Angelillo. She's Green Sea's marketing director. Dawn, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Rick.
You're welcome. Listeners, to speak with Dawn about Green Sea, you can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. The email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Dawn, give us a history of Green Sea.
Well, Green Sea was started 15 years ago. We actually celebrated our 15th anniversary this summer by a gentleman called Ben Kinneman. And Ben, he kind of came to be as a commercial diver and started to pilot ROVs. So ROVs are remotely operated vehicles that go under the water. So basically underwater drones for people like me who can't remember acronyms.
Boy, that's interesting because that's exactly what, as I was researching Green Sea, I thought they're like underwater drones, aren't they? So
they at least
get a little bit of it.
Yeah, we actually don't make the drone itself. We make the software that the drone runs on. We have quite a few manufacturers that use our product. But Ben started as a diver, then got interested in ROVs and working with them, and ended up going to graduate school and getting his master's degree in robotics, and came up with this rather clever, kind of forward-thinking idea about what robots underwater could be doing. And he brought it to his current boss at the time, who said, you know, now that's never going to happen. And he said, okay, well, I'm going to quit my job and I'm going to do this. And at the same time, he and his wife who has her PhD as well, very smart people, these Kinnemans. He said, you know, we've always liked going to Vermont. Let's move to Vermont. So they did. And they found a spot in Richmond. And that was kind of, you know, like a lot of people that moved to Vermont, they came because they loved it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they loved the atmosphere. They loved the, the outdoorsiness of it. They loved the same reason I moved to Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
Just fell in love with it. And he said, okay, this is where we're going. And once he got here, the environment for Vermont was so encouraging for developing technology. And he was able to find a lot of like-minded people to kind of offer advice and assistance. And, you know, he set up shop in his house and started the company and added a few employees, and then one day had this massive ROV set up in his living room, and his wife finally said, no, Les, you need to find a new spot. So they moved to Richmond, and we ended up, Ben ended up getting the building where the old Richmond grocery was, right on the Four Corners at the stoplight there. And that's where we are. And we started, so I started there in 2017, and there were probably, you know, maybe 15 to 20 employees at the time. And now we're up to, we'll be over 50 by the end of the year.
Oh, and my.
Yeah, we have locations. We have two locations now in Richmond. We've recently leased space in the Creamery just down the road from us. And we opened up a location in Plymouth, Mass. In January of 2020. So you might imagine what that was like. We had one month before the, you know, before the pandemic hit. And that's kind of a 30-second overview.
That's excellent.
15 years.
Yeah. And really great to hear how you've settled in Richmond, but also how well the company's doing, how it's grown. Now, let's talk about the products that Green Sea produces.
Sure.
I know it's their software, but then you do have the ROVs produced. So tell us about what they are, what they do.
Okay. So I'm going to give you the kindergarten level version of
Thank
it, which is as far as I understand.
I think the listeners would probably understand more, but for me, I think keeping it K, you know, there, kindergarten, that's probably just
that. Yeah.
Right. Thanks.
Yeah. So the ROVs themselves, we don't actually make. So we work with other manufacturers. So, you know, companies who build ROVs and have this desire to put together vehicles will come to us and say, hey, we need a control system. We need a navigation product. We need, you know, a user interface. So that's what we do. We do the control, the user interface, the navigation product. So a lot of, you know, if you think of space, and everybody kind of understands NASA and how, you know, what it might take to put a spaceship, you know, on the moon or to Mars or wherever they're going. It's almost as difficult to do something subsea, but the parameters are flipped. So instead of dealing with, you know, no pressure, we're dealing with, you know, way more pressure. So that's why there's very little research, and we haven't advanced as far subsea as we have probably, you know, through space, but we have the same issues. And one of those issues is navigation. So to know where you are, based on where you've been. So GPS does not work underwater. As soon as you get about a meter below the water, you know, you can't pick up a GPS signal, because that would be a really simple way now for us to, you know where the vehicle is at any one point in time.
Mm-hmm.
So subsea navigation is all done the old-fashioned way, the way they used to do ship navigation before they had GPS, which is, you know where you are at a certain set point of time, you know where you're traveling, you know your speed, your direction, you know, I guess it would be acceleration and direction. And then you can figure out from that and the time that's transpired, from there you should be able to estimate where you are. And that's called dead reckoning. I don't know if anybody listening, if they remember old, you know, reading old historic sailing stuff, they would talk about dead reckoning and using, you know, they could only really navigate at night where they could get a bearing on a star.
Right.
And they would drop that knotted rope off the back so they would know the distance they traveled. And they had a watch that they would figure out how far. So they would use that to take a guess as to where they were. And depending on their math skills and how accurate they were, would determine how correct the position was. It's the same thing for navigating undersea, except now we use, you know, sensors that tell us what heading we're at, accelerometers that can tell how we're moving through the current, and all of that combines to make an inertial navigation system. So there's a bunch of high-powered math that goes on inside a computer in the vessel that figures out where it is.
Wow.
So we do provide navigation product. A lot of times people who are building a ROV, and the types of people and or companies making ROV, they're either commercial products or they might be scientifics, or they might be made by someone who's very wealthy that has an interest in it. And I, for example, one of our previous customers was a company called Vulcan, and that was a company that was developed by Paul Allen, who was totally into World War II sunken ships and aircraft and things like that. So he decided he would research this. There was nobody doing the work, so he wanted to do it, and he loved it. So they were a big customer of ours, and they had an ROV that would go down 6,000 meters, or more than 6,000 meters. And he was the first person to find the USS Indianapolis back in 2017 or 2018, when that ship was found.
Fascinating
but
stuff.
Sadly, you know, Paul Allen has passed away.
Yeah.
You know, no one's really pursuing that from a personal standpoint. But there's other very large ROVs that we've been part of, like the University of Hawaii and the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research, Embari Research Institute has a deep ROV. The Schmidt Ocean Institute has a deep ROV. But then there's other smaller ROVs that are, you know, used for daily work underwater. One of the things, when I first came to Green Sea, I had no idea that under pretty much every large body of water, there's work being done. For example, Green Sea helped with a cable lay. One of the electrical grid cables runs underneath Lake Champlain.
Oh, right.
And there's a New York side and a Vermont side, and they redid cables age just like anything else, and they wanted to replace the cables before they actually started to malfunction. So, you know, the public utilities hire a company to lay a cable alongside, you know, down underneath Lake Champlain, connecting the two points. And Green Sea provided the ROV support for that.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty fun. And I had no idea that existed. So even something like Lake Champlain has a fair amount of underwater work being done. You kind of mentioned in your intro that, you know, what we were doing with ROVs, we pretty much go all over the world.
I would imagine. And let's go to the phones where we've got Fred. Fred, go right ahead.
Good morning. This is an interesting, because I'm wondering if supercomputers in robotics is going to cause a social problem in the not-too-distant future. Shock everyone to silence.
Like in Terminator?
No, not like in Terminator. I mean, like for instance, we went from the agrarian economy into the industrial economy, and that transfer seemed to work quite smoothly. But I'm afraid this next transfer is going to cause social problems. Again.
Well, I'm certainly not an expert on this, nor can I see the future. But I have a friend who has a teenage daughter, and she overheard her daughter say, you know, I'm just not going to take a job that's, you know, that I don't like. And she was referring to, you know, she probably considers menial work. So we're going to have a whole generation of employees that don't want to do the physical work. They just want to do this, oh, I can sit in a chair and program, or I can do, I want to do this. I want to be paid a lot of money, but not really working the way somebody of my generation or even an older generation would consider hard work. So I think it could very easily flow into, you know, that next transition might be awesome for the type of people that are going to be, you know, of work age in the next 5 to 10 years. That's just my guess.
All right, Fred, thanks for that call. I'm sorry. I had problems with my headphones here, so I missed that whole conversation. I'm glad that Fred took over as the new host of the show. And, Dawn, you did a great job answering things. Dawn, what is the significance of the name Green Sea?
Well, it's really, you know, we are a subsea product. So, and then it was Green Mountain. So our logo is actually kind of a look of mountains in verse on what would be a water scene. So it's really just the green mountains and the ocean. You know, so I was saying that we're all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And why Richmond? I mean, why not? It's we have a really close proximity to Lake Champlain, which is a fabulous place to drop a vehicle into the water. And we may not be able to do those super large vehicle testing. But that's usually done in a pool, and then it's going to be going off the shore in the ocean anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really not hindered. And then where we are hindered is trying to get potential employees, if they aren't already in Vermont, to move to Vermont. And sometimes that's not the easiest thing to do. And so, you know, that was why we kind of came up with the location in Plymouth, Mass., which is right on the ocean. So we have that availability. But then there's also that marine group of companies that are down there where it's a little bit easier to find employees that might be looking for work.
Well, what kind of skills does someone need to work at Green Sea?
Well, there's a plethora of different types of positions. So lots of different things, everything from what you'd usually see in a business, you know, people answering the phones and, you know, doing the marketing and selling the product, to engineers and robotics engineers. And so the engineering group usually has, you know, a lot of them have advanced degrees in either physics or robotics or computer science. And then, you know, then there's engineering degrees, there's testing types of positions where people are actually using the product. And, you know, there's a range, but like any manufacturing or, you know, software development company, there's the engineering's the important bit. So, yeah, a lot of super smart people. And when I first started working at Green Sea, there were probably 3 women, 4 women to, you know, 17 guys. And now we've really upped the number of women that work for us. And we keep adding, you know, in both engineering positions, support positions, sales positions. We aren't quite equal yet, but we're getting closer. Did I answer that question? Did you lose your headphones?
And okay. I have just 2 minutes left, but you can take me on okay. One more underwater sea adventure of somebody using a Green Sea product.
Sure. We sell a lot to the U.S. military, and they use ROVs to look for mines. There's a lot of unexploded ordnance that are subsea, left over from World War II, as well as it's a very easy target to make a, you know, EOD. That's one thing we learned, is making a bomb is pretty easy. And so the U.S. Navy uses a ROV that has our software on it, using EOD workspace to look for explosive devices. So, and to either track them or detonate, you know, put a charge on them so that they blow them up themselves, or, and using a robot, it used to all be done by divers. And now using a robot is probably certainly a whole lot safer than sending a diver in to look at a bomb. So they're also used for port security. Oil and gas industry uses those smaller ROVs to inspect offshore rigs. Same for offshore wind farms, offshore fish farms. They use to inspect netting and things. If they're operating a fish farm, they'll use an ROV instead of a diver. We also have a new product that actually will be cleaning ship hulls, which is really exciting and looking towards the future. Because one of the things everybody knows that ships get covered with biofouling, and we're making a product that will be used to kind of combat the biofouling that might be on a ship. And the shipping industry is quite large, so we anticipate that that could be a, if we can solve the riddle, then that will open up some new markets for us.
Dawn DeAngelillo is the marketing director of Green Sea Systems based in Richmond. Their website address is greensea.com. Dawn, thanks so much for your time this morning.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests, and you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. The Vermont Viewpoint podcast, sponsored by The Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sarah's up next. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.